This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's intelligence ministry says it has identified and arrested several people involved in Wednesday's deadly terrorist attacks in the seventh city of Kerman. A Palestinian politician says violent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinian people have increased since the beginning of the onslaught on Gaza. Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says it has carried out hundreds of anti-Israel operations in support of Palestinian resistance in Gaza. Thank you for joining us. Now, Iran's intelligence ministry says it has identified and arrested several people involved in the Kerman terrorist attacks. In a statement, the ministry said it had identified one of the suicide bombers as a Tajik citizen. Also, 11 members of the terrorist logistics team were arrested across six provinces of Iran. Some of the terrorist pieces of equipment discovered at their residence include suicide vests, remote control devices, and detonators. The ministry says it will continue operations until the last person involved is arrested. The deadly terror attacks rocked the city of Kerman on Wednesday as thousands were attending the assassination anniversary of top anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani.
On January the 3rd, 2024, twin terrorist explosions hit an event in the Iranian city of Kerman, marking the fourth anniversary of the assassination of senior Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The two explosions occurred minutes apart at two different locations packed with civilians. Some of the injured recount the horror that they've been through.
I think it was 3 o'clock when the explosion happened. People were running toward me. I saw several injured lying on the ground. I was scared. It was very awful. The air was dusty. I really don't want to remember that moment again.
There was an explosion that caused a commotion, and suddenly there was a second blast that made people more afraid. Shrapnel could be seen, and people were falling on each other. I can't describe. I can only say that it was a terrible moment.
The terrorist attacks have drawn strong condemnation from Iran, other countries, and international bodies, including the United Nations. The Security Council has called it a reprehensible act whose perpetrators should be held to account. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has vowed those behind the cowardly terrorist bombings cannot get away with their crime.
This flood of people that poured towards the grave of Haj Qasem these days, you come to scare the people within your criminal act. You're not strong enough to face the resistance. Your power has lost its effectiveness against the forces of resistance. Now you're targeting innocent people? Know that you will pay a heavy price for this horrible crime.
Meanwhile, the drama took a new twist when the Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility for the bombings. Some experts argued that the terrorist attacks bore all the hallmarks of an Israeli operation rather than one by Daesh.
Whoever is behind it, and I think we can assume who that is, that this has the United States and Israel written all over it.
Some Iranian media also cast doubt over Daesh being behind the attacks, as the terrorist group has a different modus operandi. These media believe the Daesh statement was in fact drawn up by the Israeli regime. They say this proves Israel is really scared of the consequences of its criminal act and that Daesh is a tool in the hands of the Tel Aviv regime. But whoever behind the deadly terrorist act, one thing is certain. And that is, the terrorists have failed to achieve their objectives by killing innocent civilians.
United as always, Iranians gathered after Friday prayers in the capital, Tehran, to show their outrage and acts of terror in the country after scores of people were killed in bombings in Kerman. They say while it was Daesh which claimed responsibility for the terrorist attack, the U.S. and its regional ally Israel are actually behind these atrocities.
Daesh is created by the U.S. Former U.S. President Donald Trump once said that Obama was the founder of Daesh. They have caused disasters in the country for more than 40 years, but our people are still standing for the Islamic Revolution. Are they blind? How did they not see this?
Israel and the U.S. have a long history of hostility against the Iranian people. Wednesday terrorist attacks in Kerman were an obvious proof of that, as they've been supporting different terrorist groups, including Daesh, in the region.
Daesh?
Daesh couldn't do this by itself. It has a supporter. Their supporters are the U.S. and Israel.
Mothers were among those taking part in the rally. I asked them how they felt when they saw the dead bodies of innocent people as the attack occurred on Mother's Day in Iran.
There's no doubt that Israel and the U.S. were behind this horrific terrorist attack. It hurts every human being's feeling when on Mother's Day they see a mother killed while holding her baby.
During the rally, people also mourned for a 20-year-old girl named Faizeh Rahimi. Faizeh was a student who was killed in the attack. Iranian students of all ages were participating in the rally to show their support for martyrs like Faizeh.
Imam Khomeini once said, "Kill us, but our nation will become more awakened."
Western-backed terrorist attacks in Iran have mainly targeted popular backing for the Islamic Republic, but the people say they will continue to support the establishment and hold heroes like martyr Qasem Soleimani in their hearts. Farzan Ashuryan, Tehran.
The World Health Organization says Israel has attacked hospitals and other vital medical infrastructure nearly 600 times since the regime launched its onslaught on Gaza. The WHO said at least 613 people have been killed in the airstrikes on health facilities. The world body also condemned the persisting bombardment, saying such attacks are pushing Palestinians in Gaza to the breaking point. Meanwhile, the WHO chief says many wounded Palestinians in Gaza have a reduced possibility of saving their limbs. That's because they are receiving care several days after being injured. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus also says lack of treatment and experts lead to amputations, adding that some patients undergo surgery without anesthesia and pain relief. Palestinians trapped in the besieged Gaza Strip are desperately struggling with severe scarcity of daily necessities. They are facing water shortages and lack of sanitation. Let's take a listen to some of them talking about their dire situation.
We have children with us, but there are no shelters. We have women and children, but there is no food, no water, no daily necessities. What we drink is salty groundwater. There are patients with kidney diseases and pregnant women, but we don't have nursery rooms and professional doctors. Babies don't have milk. Please look at us in Gaza. Our women, children, and elderly are suffering. Think about the dead and the injured we've been forced to leave behind.
There's a water shortage. As you can see, there is no water. People stand in line and go around the region to look for any source of water for their children. We have so many problems. In the camp inside, we have no water, no service or care, no hygiene. Regarding the face masks, it caused a lot of sickness for children and elderly that have health problems. And as you can see on the streets, there are many face masks everywhere, and there is no municipality to take care of people. It's spreading everywhere, and even insects invaded the houses and the streets.
A Palestinian politician says Israeli settlers have stepped up violent attacks against Palestinians since October the 7th. Mustafa Barghouti says every settler and trooper feels they have the green light to shoot and kill Palestinians with a feeling of total immunity. His comments came as an Israeli NGO says there is an unmatched surge in settlement activity in the occupied West Bank. Peace Now, which monitors such activity, says settlers have carried out record new construction in a span of 3 months. That's on newly seized Palestinian land, where settlers have also built new roads and set up roadblocks. All Israeli settlement activities are considered illegal under international law. The leader of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says no Israeli military post in the north of the occupied territories has been spared from the group's strikes.
The Islamic Resistance carried out more than 670 operations during a period of 3 months. 670. In some days, the number of operations reached 23. The average is between 6 to 7 military operations daily. The border posts which were targeted, 48 border posts, meaning that not one border post from Nakoura to the end of the Shabah farms, not one was spared. All of them were targeted more than once. This is the number of posts, but the number of targeting, 494.
Without any doubt. Nasrallah said the group has forced Israeli soldiers to evacuate many posts near Lebanon, and the rest are, in his words, hiding like rats. He also said the regime is censoring the number of his casualties to avoid boosting the morale of the resistance fighters. Nasrallah also reiterated that the assassination of a senior leader of the Hamas resistance movement in Beirut will not go unpunished.
Many are still asking. I say, of course, this will not go unanswered. And it won't go unpunished. And we won't use the term at the right time and place. The decision, brothers and sisters, the decision is on the battlefield. The battlefield will respond. The battlefield doesn't wait, and so this response is coming without any doubt, and we cannot be silent to a violation of such level, such a dangerous violation, because this means that all of Lebanon would be exposed, all of the cities and villages and all of the figures, personalities will become exposed. The scale of the danger, the scale of the threat, the scale of the negative repercussions as a result of being silent towards this violation is bigger than any other dangers which we might resort to when we respond to this aggression. So the response is coming without any doubt, God willing.
Nasrallah also hailed the resistance groups in the region for their support for Palestine. He said Yemen has now become a part of the international equation and has exposed the U.S. as the true source of instability in the Red Sea. Nasrallah also condemned the recent targeting of a leader of the popular mobilization units in Baghdad. He said Iraqis now have a historic opportunity to expel U.S. forces from their land. On the 4th martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Iran's Sacred Defense Museum has opened a new exhibition to the public. Dubbed the Resistance Hall, the exhibition allows a glimpse into the top commander's personal life and his illustrious military career. Gisumisha Ahmadi tells us more.
The life and legacy of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, honoring the sacrifices he made and inspiring future generations. The Resistance Hall of Tehran's Sacred Defense Museum is dedicated to the top commander.
The significance of Qasem Soleimani was spreading the message of the Islamic Revolution throughout the world. And due to his activities and actions and efforts, the decline of the United States internationally speeded up. And it was the result of his work that the United States policies in this part of the world failed and continue to fail.
The exhibition takes visitors back in time to the era of the Iran-Iraq War and other regional conflicts in which the top commander played a decisive role.
The exhibition has 12 sections, each of which pertains to a specific era of General Soleimani's life, from the imposed war to conflicts in Bosnia and Herzegovina, Lebanon, Yemen, Palestine, and most importantly, the fight against Daesh terrorists. Visitors can easily acquaint themselves with Haj Qasim and his way of life and his legacy as they walk down the hall and visit different sections.
Following a chronological timeline, the exhibition is incredibly comprehensive in its coverage of the role Haj Qasim played as a top military commander and strategist, and for many visitors, probably the most interesting part they might know little about is Bosnia and Herzegovina.
You know, if we did not have Iran on our side, if Iran did not help, then I'm doubting if Bosnia and Herzegovina would exist nowadays. Iranian help was detrimental in this, the hardest period of Bosnian life. And Soleimani had important role in all of that. So when we remember him, remember really contribution of great nation of Iran.
An all-too-familiar description of the top commander, as many nations believe him to have done the same for them as well, including Palestinians.
90% of the Palestinians are supporting the resistance, which means that anyone, in particular those leaders who played a great role or have their own imprint in developing the resistance, like Haj Soleimani, rahmatullah alayh, I'm sure they have a special place in the minds and hearts of a lot of Palestinians.
But fighting Daesh terrorists and eventually defeating them is probably what Haj Qasim is best known for. With the final section of the exhibition showcasing remains of that war, along with a wax statue of the hero himself right next to the vehicles he used to ride back then. A hero in the fight against terrorism. General Qasim Soleimani is a symbol of courage to whom people in the region owe their freedom and security. Gizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime openly targets ambulances in Gaza, in addition to hospitals and healthcare personnel in the besieged enclave. There is no respect for international law or any concern for the protection of health professionals. The risk is so extreme that wounded and besieged people are often left without anyone to turn to, as paramedics are unable to reach them. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Mohammad is a paramedic and he talks about the unique risks such work poses in Gaza, where Israel has proven time and again that its repeated and brutal assaults cause massive numbers of civilian casualties. The 28-year-old had been a paramedic for 9 years. During that time, he witnessed three major Israeli aggressions in 2014, 2021 and 2022, countless minor ones, as well as the Great March of Return protest in 2018 to 2019. It is a period that saw the killing of nearly 1,900 civilians in Gaza, a number that now pales in comparison to the current genocide. Paramedics have always been targets for the Zionist regime's violence. In 2014, Amnesty International called for an international investigation into mounting evidence of apparently deliberate targeting of hospitals and health professionals in Gaza. During the 18 months of the Great March of Return protest, health workers were similarly targeted. The period saw three fatalities and some 800 injuries to health professionals, promoting the Association of International Development Agencies, which comprises more than 80 international aid groups, to denounce Israel's Gaza blockade, repeated Israeli military offenses and attacks on healthcare facilities and personnel that are carried out with impunity, without consequences and without accountability. Attacks on Gaza's medical sector were, in other words, common long before October 7th. But this time, the Zionist regime's attacks on health sector are incomparable. According to Medical Aid for Palestinians, Israel has killed at least 300 health professionals since October 7th, more than in all other conflicts in the world combined since 2016. Dozens have been abducted, including the heads of hospitals like Dr. Muhammad Abu Salmiya, Ashrafa's director, and Dr. Ahmad Muhanna, the head of Al-Auda Hospital in central Gaza. Many, including Abu Salmiya, have not been heard from since their kidnapping. Such a disappearance is itself a war crime. The Zionist regime also kidnapped Muhammad Afna while he was transporting patients. He was reportedly released, but people haven't been able to reach them or any of his friends or family since to check on him. Muhammad has been a paramedic since 2014 when he finished his training at the Emergency Officers and Drivers Rehabilitation Institute in Gaza. His training was immediately put to the test when the 2014 war struck. Muhammad told reporters in September, "The first rule a paramedic is taught is your safety first. It is a rule paramedics regularly have to interpret in Gaza," he said. He added, "If we do not respond to calls because it is dangerous out there, we won't be able to help anyone." Muhammad has had a number of close calls. During the Great March of Return, he was a member of the rescue team at the field trauma stabilization point close to the buffer zones along Gaza's eastern boundaries. Once, when the shooting was crazy, indiscriminate, and everywhere, he remembered, "Everyone panicked. Everyone started to run. I fell 12 meters down a hill. I woke up in the hospital," he said. One night, a colleague right next to him was shot in the leg. In 2021, an ambulance in which Muhammad was riding was shelled while attempting a rescue near Al-Aqsa TV station. Some 112 ambulances were damaged in the Zionist regime's attacks over a period of the Great March of Return protest from March 2018 until December 2019. While Muhammad in September said the period of the March of Return was the worst he could remember, it has been completely overshadowed by the current situation. Since October 7th, more than 100 ambulances have been attacked and put out of service. The The Zionist regime openly targets ambulances now, in addition to hospitals and healthcare personnel. There is no respect for international law or any concern for the protection of health professionals. The risk is so extreme that wounded and besieged people are often left without anyone to turn to as paramedics are unable to reach them. Mohammad is a father of three, two daughters and a son, and lives in a family building where his parents also reside. During times of conflict, he said he may spend 4 or 5 days away from home before being able to return for a shower or a change of clothes. His family's constant roaring results in frequent calls, though he can only respond to a few. During such periods, he would normally work a 24-hour shift followed by 2 days rest. Often, however, the intense need for paramedics means they are prevented from going home. In addition, there is a sense of duty. Mohammad remembers vividly a call he received at the beginning of the 2021 escalation after a house was bombed. He said, "A family of a girl and her parents were barbecuing in their yard. It was difficult to reach them. The man and his daughter were killed. A 1,000-liter water tank had crushed them. Only the mother survived, but she was severely injured. The 2014 assault was also brutal. There was a shortage of ambulances during the Shajaya massacre in Gaza City when people were forced to evacuate at night." He said, "The evacuation continued from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. with people running around in panic. We transported them to UNRWA schools in the An-Nasr neighborhood. We saved as many as we could, but unfortunately, many lives were lost."
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, let us contemplate upon the words of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, regarding his blissful marital life with Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. "By Allah, I never angered Fatima or forced her to do something she did not like up to the day that she passed away. Nor did she ever anger or disobey me. In fact, when I looked at her, depression and sadness would vanish from my heart."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, hating covetousness. Covetousness is the state of being eager or excessive desire, especially for wealth or possessions.
Similarly, covetousness brings abjectness and sin. Covetousness means having or showing a strong desire for especially material possessions. If one is eager to acquire material possessions or wealth, naturally their goal would be to strive on the path of worldliness, right? They would be a victim of hubb ad-dunya, the love of this world. Why? Because they are so eager and passionate and they have this strong desire to accumulate material possessions, right? Wealth, money, property, cars, gadgets, you know, so on and so forth. The first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, says, "The best affairs are those which are far from covetousness." Why did he say this? If you notice, the reason is that if covetousness becomes a trait of one's personality, he or she can never think about the affairs of the hereafter. Isn't that right? Because that person would be so consumed in the everyday life of this dunya, right? They would be running after this dunya. They would be chasing this dunya. They would become a part of this rat race to acquire this dunya and its belongings, right? So this, of course, and naturally, is going to take them away from the real purpose of their life, which is to achieve that perfection, the spiritual, moral, and ethical perfection, which connects them strongly with the Creator, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of hating covetousness. And we said that it is a vice, it is an evil that takes control of our lives if we fall in this trap. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, "Restraint strengthens faith and covetousness destroys it." Covetousness is an enemy of one's faith, brothers and sisters. Islam encourages us to settle with the material belongings that Allah has granted us, while greed and covetousness compels one to run after this dunya and its material belongings. So see how opposite they are in nature, in its very essence. Imam Ali alayhi salam also said, "The abjectness of men is in their covetousness." He also said, "Beware of the deception of covetousness, for it brings you hardship." Sometimes shaitan, Iblis, makes us believe that if we run after this dunya, our lives will become easier. But if you notice, Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying quite the opposite. Imam Ali alayhi salam is telling us that if you run after this dunya and the belonging of this dunya and the wealth of this dunya, then your life is going to be, in a nutshell, miserable, right? Amir al-Mu'mineen in one place says, "Anyone who does not purify his soul from the abjectness of covetousness abases himself, and in the hereafter his abasement is more and worse." So again, like we said before, they would have to, you know, in some cases, pay the price in both the worlds, in this dunya and in the hereafter. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam said, "What a bad person is he who has covetousness, which incites him." He also said, "Seek for the survival of your honor through the killing of covetousness."
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
شهيد القدس.
Part 2.
The saddest day in Iran since Imam Khomeini, God's blessing upon his soul, passed away. Millions of people swarmed the streets of the Iranian capital, Tehran. They were filled with both rage and grief. Qasem Soleimani was assassinated. Not the leader or president or any other state official delivered a speech to the crowd that day. There was only one thing in the field, and that was the exact same thing that outshone all his medals of honor. On September 8th, 2000, Ariel Sharon, leader of the extremist party in the Israeli regime's cabinet, went to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It triggered widespread protests throughout Palestine. It was the moment Soleimani and the resistance groups in Palestine and Lebanon had prepared for. They were scheduled to establish a special task force to make the coordination between the Quds Force and the Palestinian resistance movements and Hezbollah. Soleimani was at the helm of the task force. After dividing the responsibilities, the foundation was set to help the Intifada grow. After Israel's withdrawal from the Lebanese border, the new conditions on the border provided ample opportunities. Dozens of educational videos, like this one, were made to be used by resistance groups inside Palestine. These videos included different individual weapons, explosives, besides methods to make bombs in primitive ways. That was how martyrdom-seeking operations resumed. The flames raged inside Israel. The Israelis had to face their worst nightmares. In the political arena, Ariel Sharon, who had assumed his post as Israel's prime minister, sought to deal a major blow to the Intifada by assassinating Abu Ali Mustafa, the secretary general of the Popular Resistance Movement, in August of 2001. But 2 weeks later, the Popular Front reacted to the assassination of its secretary general by exacting revenge on Ariel Sharon's tourism minister, Rehavam Zeevi. But the big question on everyone's mind about Intifada from day one was how the relationship with Yasser Arafat and the Fatah movement would be. A wide range of discussions on the issue between Haj Qasem and his team, headed by Imad Mughniyeh, started under the circumstances that the Al-Aqsa Brigades, the military wing of the Fatah movement, had launched its military activities from the first days of Intifada. Mughniyeh took advantage of his deep knowledge about the Fatah movement because the movement was based in Beirut in the past. In the end, it was decided not to turn down any group that sought to do anything against the Zionist enemy. And Arafat asked for help. On January 3, 2002, the Israeli regime's media reported that a ship containing several tons of weapons was confiscated. The ship's name was Karine A. The weapons were sent from Iran to the Fatah movement. All of the crew on board, headed by General Omar Akawi, a close Arafat aide, were arrested. The U.S. and Israeli regime coordinated the operation to confiscate the ship.
We are deeply disturbed by the arrival of the ship in the region and the fact that it could have completed its mission and offloaded weapons that would have been put to the worst kind of use against Israel and others in the region. I'm glad the Israelis intercepted it, and now we have to find all those responsible and accountable for this incident.
They started to impose a siege on Yasser Arafat in Ramallah. Sharon gave the thumbs up for the so-called Operation Defensive Shield for the attack in the West Bank, but it faced a heroic resistance in Nablus and Jenin. On April 5, 2002, Marwan Barghouti, the Secretary General of the Fatah movement, was arrested in the West Bank. A few days later, Jihad Jibril, Ahmad Jibril's son, the Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, General Command, was assassinated in Beirut because of his role in reinforcing the Intifada. On July 22nd the same year, Salah Shahade, the commander of the Izzaddin al-Qassam Brigades, was assassinated. The incident filled Intifada with rage. After the third year of Intifada, the hopes that the flames of the uprising would be put out were dashed. Sharon kicked off the policy of assassination. On March 22, 2004, Israeli helicopters assassinated Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the founder of the Hamas movement. In Damascus, at the headquarters of the political leaders of Hamas, a commemoration ceremony was scheduled to be held at a house. A few hours later, Qasem Soleimani went to that place to express his condolences.
Nothing will be changed if it is by Apache or by cardiac arrest. I prefer to be by Apache.
On April 18, 2004, less than a year after Sheikh Ahmed Yassin had been assassinated, Dr. Abdulaziz Rantisi, the person who succeeded Sheikh Ahmed Yassin in Gaza, was assassinated. Hezbollah also received its share amid the developments. At first, Ali Saleh, and after that, Ghalib Awali, two top officials dealing with Palestine's case in the Lebanese resistance movement, were assassinated. The operations indicated the huge blow the Intifada had dealt to Israel. There were heated arguments in Israel on how to suppress the Intifada. On November 11, 2004, Yasser Arafat was martyred. A few years later, lab tests showed that he had fallen victim to a biological assassination by the Israeli regime spy agency, the Mossad. On January 9, 2005, Mahmoud Abbas was picked as chairman of the Palestinian Authority. Intifada had worn the Zionist regime out. On August 15, 2005, after Israeli settlers left the last neighborhoods in Gaza, the territory was completely liberated. The liberation was a golden opportunity for the resistance and Haj Qasim to go forward in their struggle.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has a long history of systematically undermining the health rights of Palestinians and utilizing destructive tactics to achieve its ends. The Zionist regime practices medical apartheid. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The Fourth Geneva Convention obligates an occupying power to ensure that proper medical supplies are provided and that hospitals and health services are maintained in the territory under occupation. The Zionist regime is doing the exact opposite. It is subjecting healthcare to collective punishment so that Palestinians are tortured, displaced, and killed. The Zionist regime has a long history of systematically undermining the health rights of Palestinians and utilizing destructive tactics to achieve its ends. The Zionist regime practices medical apartheid. Though not defined formally in international human rights law, the term medical apartheid has been used to describe similar situations of pervasive segregation and discrimination in healthcare based on race, and characterized by stark inequalities in healthcare accessibility, availability, and quality. The Zionist regime has been hampering the development of, destroying, and openly targeting the Palestinian healthcare system. The system was built and supported mainly by international donors." Strategically, the Zionist regime made Palestinian healthcare dependent on aid. Over the years, Israel has been attacking health facilities, medical workers, and ambulances in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Since October 7th, the Zionist regime has repeatedly attacked hospitals and medical centers in order to push people out of Gaza. It has caused a scarcity of medical supplies, fuel, and necessities such as food and water for the same purpose. The estimated 800,000 people who remained in northern Gaza after the Zionist regime's evacuation orders have been left without any healthcare, apart from some failed medical points that cannot provide anything beyond first aid. Hospitals have been put out of service after the Zionist regime attacked them, threatening the lives of patients, displaced people and healthcare personnel. The same steps are being taken in southern Gaza. The Zionist regime is now carrying out ethnic cleansing against Palestinians by wiping out the basics of life in the south. That includes healthcare infrastructure. The scale of human losses is enormous. Survivors have been left with no choice but an exodus. The underlying problems, de-development and destruction of healthcare, started a long time before October 7th. For almost 17 years, a blockade has meant that Gaza's healthcare system cannot function properly. The health ministry has been unable to provide sustainable services. The Zionist regime has deliberately restricted access to medicines and essential equipment such as medical imaging devices. Israel has prevented the entry of X-ray and other scanning machines and spare parts based on claims that they can be used both for civilian and military purposes. By February 2022, Israel had approved only 30 out of 120 requests submitted by the Palestinian Authority in 2021 for the entry of such equipment into Gaza. Under siege, Gaza has not been able to devote the resources needed for training and recruiting specialized staff. That has undermined the capacity of hospitals to offer specialized services such as oncology, nephrology, cardiology, and advanced surgeries. Moreover, patients who require specialized care frequently cannot access it outside Gaza. Restrictions on movement have condemned many to deaths that were preventable. In 2021 alone, more than 36% of applications for permits to receive treatment outside Gaza were either refused or left unanswered. According to the Fourth Geneva Convention, hospitals, clinics, ambulances, and their staff are protected at all times so they can freely treat the wounded and sick. Attacks against them are war crimes and violations of international law. Over the years, the Zionist regime has faced no consequences for its attacks. Since October 7th, the Zionist regime has attacked more than 140 health institutions, putting 23 hospitals and 53 medical centers out of service. The Zionist regime has killed more than 300 healthcare workers, some with a huge amount of experience. Many have been attacked at home with their families or while on duty. Such attacks are clearly assassinations. Their aim is to deprive Gazans of any hope of being saved or treated. The ground invasion enabled the Zionist regime's forces to meticulously select their targets among medical staff after besieging hospitals or blocking the roads used by ambulances. The Zionist regime has abducted approximately 100 healthcare workers. They include Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, director of Ashifa, Gaza's largest hospital, and Dr. Akram Hussein, head of the surgery department at Gaza's Indonesian hospital. Worsened by the ground invasion, the obstruction of ambulances is becoming a more commonly practiced tool of medical apartheid. The wounded are left to bleed to death without help. In addition to this overt destruction, the Zionist regime has engineered a public health crisis. Israel's actions have led to the rapid spread of illnesses such as diarrhea, scabies, lice, chickenpox, skin rash, hepatitis A, and upper respiratory infections. The disruption of vaccination programs, overcrowding at shelters and winter weather exacerbate the problems. Similarly, the tightening of blockades since the war began, and particularly the restrictions on the entry of essential medical supplies, has led to a surge in deaths that could have been prevented. Until now, more than 9,000 people are reported to have died during the war because hospitals lacked resources and supplies and could not conduct operations. These include patients who died from infections and death in humane circumstances. They also include patients with chronic diseases who have not been able to find medicines. The effects of continuous bombardment on mental health is just as profound as the physical effects. Yet, mental health services remain grossly inadequate, exacerbating the suffering. According to reports, more than 60% of homes in Gaza have been destroyed in the current war. Universities, factories, governmental buildings, and hospitals have been attacked. All this violence makes it impossible to provide the services necessary for life and impacts the livelihoods and mental health of Gaza's people. The destruction and displacement which the Zionist regime is causing appears to be a strategic move to make Gaza unlivable. Gazans are being pushed to leave Gaza. This approach is reminiscent of ethnic cleansing, as UN experts have noted. Urgent action is imperative to end the war, lift the blockade, and ensure the free flow of essential supplies and skilled professionals to Gaza. Rebuilding healthcare infrastructure and giving comprehensive support are crucial steps to mitigate the devastating effect of the Zionist regime's war on Gaza.
Midstream.
In November, the Yemeni armed forces declared war on the Zionist entity in support of the resistance in Gaza, presenting a significant and unwelcome surprise for the entity. Yemen initiated missile and drone attacks on targets in the Zionist Israeli port of Eilat, overlooking the Red Sea. However, the Yemeni armed forces did not stop there and announced the imposition of what could be described as a naval blockade on the entity. It appears that there are significant losses due to the Yemeni missiles, prompting the Pentagon in the first week of December to announce a plan to form a naval force to so-called protect international navigation in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and the Red Sea. However, despite the availability of European countries' warships and frigates, they do not express great enthusiasm to join this force. Well, that is mainly due to the fact that European countries do not possess a large naval fleet. Warships are distributed between protecting the coasts of these countries and positioning near Ukraine in anticipation of any developments in the Russian-Ukrainian war. On the other hand, these countries are concerned that if they participate in confronting the Yemeni armed forces in their Gaza support operations, their commercial ships passing through the Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea could themselves become targets for the Yemenis. In the meantime, despite the Pentagon's threat to respond to the Yemenis, the Yemeni armed forces daily reaffirm their determination to continue targeting Israeli entity ships and ships bound towards occupied Palestine until the Zionist entity ends the genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The matter is no longer limited to imposing a blockade on Zionist Israeli ports. The geostrategic battle and its escalating events are shaking the world. The closure of the Red Sea to ships colluding with the enemy turns into a heroic festival, teaching the U.S. and Zionist Israel harsh lessons and threatening them with more successive blows capable of breaking their alliances and coercive global policies. These strikes establish a new state of resistance given the expansion of its military operations and the development of its capabilities to combat malicious international hegemony. There is a clear evolution in the history of resistance post-October 7 and after the introduction of the equation of the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb.